Good evening, everyone, and thanks to all of you for being here. I'm really honored to be sharing this platform with Rabbi Shai Held and Congressman Jamie Raskin in this beautiful sanctuary. They are two of the great public figures of our time and our community. They're Jews who lead with open hearts, empathy, respect, and yes, love. Having found their own paths, they each walk in God's ways, and tonight is the first time that they're meeting each other. Rabbi Held is a teacher and a theologian and an institution builder who's one of the most highly regarded voices in the American Jewish community. Congressman Raskin, who has served in Congress since 2017, is one of our country's fiercest advocates defending our embattled democracy. We're going to be talking about Rabbi Held's groundbreaking and timely book, Judaism is About Love, which we're launching tonight. We'll be talking about, among other things, loving our neighbors and loving the stranger, gratitude and grace, loss, human rights, the mood of our country today, and restoring a spirit of compassion, and we're going to talk about God. Congressman Jamie Raskin is the U.S. Representative for Maryland's 8th District and ranking member on the House Committee on Oversight. He served as lead House manager in the second Senate impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. Which ended with a 57-43 vote to convict the president for inciting a violent insurrection against the Constitution. Congressman Raskin also served on the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. He has written several books, including the New York Times number one bestseller, Unthinkable, Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy. It's a terrific and really powerful, unforgettable book. His earlier book, We the Students, was recently banned in Texas. And in the same week, Vladimir Putin banned him from Russia for life. I've long been an admirer of your crucial work in Congress, and it's really a privilege to meet you, Jamie. Rabbi Shai Held, one of the most influential Jewish thinkers and leaders in America, is president and dean of the Hadar Institute in New York City. Rabbi Held received the prestigious Covenant Award for Excellence in Jewish Education and has been named multiple times to Newsweek's list of the most influential rabbis in America and to the Forward's list of the most prominent Jews in the world. He's the author of Abraham Joshua Heschel, The Call of Transcendence, and The Heart of Torah, Essays on the Weekly Torah Portion, along with Judaism is About Love, Recovering the Heart of Jewish Life. The book is so well written and really impressive, and the more than 200 pages of footnotes also make for really interesting reading. I've known Shai for many years, and I've been one of the people who really encouraged him to write a book like this, to bring his voice to a wide audience. So it's really great that this book is out in the world. So I have lots of questions, but I hope that the two of you will also just feel free to ask each other questions. But I thought we would start, of course, with Judaism is About Love. Shai, the book is about theology, and it also can be used as a guide to how to be in the world, how to live with love and kindness. But I thought maybe first you can define, what is love? It's really hard to define, I know, but give us a sense of what you're talking about.
Thank you, Sandy. Thank you, Jamie. Thank you, all of you. It's really a privilege to be here. Thank you, Thea, for making this all possible. So let me say a couple sentences about love, if I could. I think it's helpful to say that love, when I use it in a religious sense, is not primarily an emotion. It has emotional dimensions. But love is what I call, admittedly pretentiously, but I found this helpful in my own thinking, love is an existential posture. It is a way of holding ourselves, of comporting ourselves in the world. It is an orientation. If you prefer more philosophical language, it is a disposition to feel certain ways and act in certain ways. That's important because you cannot build a spiritual life on an emotion, because as we all know, emotions are fleeting. So when I say that a religious life is built on love, I don't mean that if you ask me at any moment of the day, what is your primary feeling tone right now, that I'm going to say, oh, it's love, right? Sometimes it's frustration, anxiety, right? Hunger. I mean, it's a lot of different things. But if you ask me what is my orientation to the world, the answer can still be love. Now, if the disposition doesn't express itself in emotion, at least some of the time, then the disposition will dissipate or maybe even doesn't exist. But it itself is not an emotion. I also think it's helpful to say that love is not, I think, ever a particular emotion. Love is an umbrella term for a whole array of emotions, what psychologists somewhat powerfully call pro-social emotions, generosity, compassion. I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking about for years is the fact that the language of the Babylonian Talmud, Babylonian Aramaic, has no way to distinguish compassion from love. The root, racham, in Aramaic means love. It also means compassion. So when we call God rachamana or rachama, that means the merciful one as well as the loving one. So compassion is obviously imagined as a form of love, as is generosity. I would argue in a certain way, so is gratitude. And gratitude, I think, is also a good example. When we talk about a religious life based on gratitude, we're not talking about having the feeling of gratitude. It doesn't mean walking around the world with a feeling of being stoned. You know, oh, I'm so grateful all the time. Sometimes I'm frustrated and bewildered and frightened about the future of the world. But the gratitude is an orientation. You can ask me what I'm feeling right now, and I might not say grateful. But if you ask me if my orientation to the world is grateful, I can still say yes. So I think that that's actually really quite important. And the reason I think it's so important to emphasize is that if we tell people that things like gratitude and love are emotions, we set up one of two possibilities. Either people lie to themselves about what they're really feeling because they want to be grateful or loving, or they give up because they feel, I can't be grateful all the time. Frankly, I'm anxious much of the time. And so actually, I think it's helpful for people to take a step back from simply an equal sign that says love and compassion and gratitude are emotions. They manifest in emotions, but they themselves are something else.
More about love. Jamie, I love the quote that you start your book Unthinkable with from Sophocles. One word frees us from all the weight and pain of life. That word is love. I wonder in what ways that quote spoke to you.
Sandy, thank you for having me and for moderating us. And Rabbi, congratulations on your very fine, beautifully written book, which I've read twice now, once fast and once slow. But I really, I liked it slow even better than when I read it fast. And
thank you for reading the script just as I gave it to you.
When I told your wonderful rabbi that when I go out to churches and mosques and synagogues, as I often do, I probably spend more time in these places than you do, Rabbi, as a politician. But I make them tell me a joke, and I got a good joke not long ago that I think is apropos our topic tonight, because it's about God and love. And so I picked it up at a church, I think an Episcopal church. But so St. Peter is walking down the hallway in heaven, and he passes God's office, and he peeks his head into God's office, and God is sitting there with his head in his hands like this. And St. Peter says, God, what's wrong? You look really upset. And God said, I am really upset. I'm in love with an atheist, and she doesn't even know I exist. There's something in that joke for everybody, you know. So, I'm delighted to be here. We don't spend a lot of time in Congress talking about love and the pro-social emotions of compassion, and tenderness and kindness and loving acts of kindness. So it's good to be in a place where these things are taken seriously and perhaps also lightheartedly too. The highest aspiration we have that we can realistically fight for is a society based on justice, and even that seems pretty distant a lot of the times. But as I was reading your book, I was starting to think about how the reason that we want to have a just society is precisely so people can lead their lives with love and compassion and friendship and kindness and the different emotions and practices that you evoke. Certainly when you go through something very, very hard, as I describe in my book, you go through, I'm sure everybody in the room has gone through profound losses and sickness and illness and problems. I think that, at least for me, that's what has concentrated my mind on love really being the compensating factor, the only thing that can really get you through it, I think. And so that underscores its central importance in our emotional life and in our social lives, I think.
Yeah, thanks. Shai, in what way is your view of love different from the Christian view of love?
I think it's important to say, it was very important to me in working on this book to make clear that in insisting that Judaism is about love, I'm not suggesting that Judaism is Christianity avant la lettre, right? That like somehow it's the same thing in a different guise. And I'm sort of very opposed to the kind of interfaith dialogue that is in fact not dialogical at all, because it just says, oh, we're all the same, right? So I think that there are a bunch of different ways to think about tendencies in Judaism and Christianity that are different. And I say tendencies because both of these traditions are vast. They're variegated. On most topics that Judaism says X about, there's also someone who chimes in and says Y, right? And Christianity too. But I think there are two tendencies that are really central. One, the hardest chapter for me by far to write in this book was a chapter on whether there's a mitzvah to love our enemies. And one of the things I try to do is to show that the kind of facile dichotomy that says Christianity says love your enemies, but Judaism says defend yourself, or some version of that, is really problematic. First of all, loving your enemies and defending yourself are not obviously in tension with each other. They might be, but they're not obviously so. And actually, Christians, this is really interesting, right? Christians agree almost universally that loving your enemies is at the heart of Jesus' teaching. But what loving your enemies means and requires is the subject of endless debate in the interpersonal sphere, in the political sphere. So it's actually very hard to simply kind of say, oh, Christianity says love your enemies. The question is, well, what does that actually mean and require? I mean, here's just one random example. Does it demand pacifism? Or on the contrary, does it demand that we sometimes violently defend those who are under assault from the powerful? Right? That's just, an example of this. Judaism, I argue, has much more of a notion of loving enemies than we are conventionally taught to think. The ethic of non-retaliation, for example, is built into our three-time-a-day prayer, where we say, "L'makalelai nafshi tidom," for those who curse me, may my heart be silent. And the rabbis praise those who bear insult without insulting back. But when it comes to the question of loving enemies, one of the things that I find helpful to say that is, I think, kind of underdeveloped in both Judaism and Christianity, to be honest, is a kind of willingness to talk about what we mean when we say enemy. Are we talking about someone I don't get along with at work? Are we talking about a family member that I had a horrible falling out with and don't speak to? Are we talking about Saddam Hussein? What are we actually talking about? Because I think that writ large, Jewish ethics answer some of those questions differently. In the book, I talk at great length about, rabbinic sources that actually emphasize the aspiration to turn enemies into friends, to heal breaches between people. Where it gets much more complicated is what is one's relationship to genocidal enemies, right? Raging anti-Semites. I think it's actually much harder. I think that the difference between Judaism and Christianity, ultimately about loving enemies, is in part that no Jewish ethicist would say the very heart of Jewish ethics is loving enemies. I just don't think you have that thought. And part of that, I just want to observe, is that it is much harder for those who are powerless and constantly under fire to talk about loving enemies than it is for those with all the power. And Jews have also understandably been skeptical of Christian talk about love of enemies because, to be blunt about it, Christians for 2,000 years defined us as enemies and then killed us. So when Christians lecture Jews about loving enemies, Jews have a kind of almost visceral reaction to that. And that's part of what fomented this idea that Judaism doesn't talk about loving your enemies. It does, just in a very nuanced way. Maybe I could talk about this more later, but I'll say the other path, just very briefly, is that in Christianity, there's a constant struggle with whether starting with the particular is legitimate. Right, so many Christian thinkers think loving your enemy means loving every person in the world equally, what philosophers call equal regard. No Jewish thinker ever is going to say you can't start with your family. The problem is you can't end there either, right? You can't, in other words, family first can easily devolve into family only. But Judaism, I think, you know, again, the larger tendency of the Jewish tradition is to really insist that the universal begins with the particular. Christians tend to be much more ambivalent on that point. And I think there are pluses and minuses to both approaches, actually. It's quite complicated.
But Jamie, I want to turn to you and this whole idea of, you know, loving one's enemies. I wonder what it's like for you these days working, in a Congress that there's so much hostility and people, you know, Joe Biden remembers working in days when, you know, people just kind of loved each other across parties. And it seems like it's a very different place these days. And I wonder how you deal with that.
So, well, the first thing I got to say about that, Sandy, is one thing I've noticed about politicians, especially when they've left office, is they always romanticize what it was like when they were in office. Like, they can't imagine how bad it is now, and which is not to diminish how bad it is now, but I mean, we've lived through other times of great enmity and hostility and political polarization and division, all of which is to say, we're going to get through this, and Donald Trump's going down in November, okay? So, But no, I actually came, I mean, I wanted to get the answer to the question of how do you love thine enemy, especially if thine enemy doesn't love the stranger. That's often the situation we're in. But, I mean, I can't exactly claim it's a theological principle for me. I mean, maybe I've got some now that I've read Shah's book, but you know, it's somewhat in my personality because I'm a middle child and I like bringing people together. And so I spent a lot of time trying to hang out with my Republican friends, which is congressional parlance for enemies. And some of my friends have actually become friends. And then some of my friends are definitely just enemies, and I still want to try to love them too. But, you know, I suppose it all depends on where you draw the circle. If you draw the circle around your caucus, you're going to see that the people's your enemies. If you draw it around the Congress or around the country or around the world, then they can't really be your enemies, you know. But anyway, take somebody who you might not guess I'd be friends with, Lauren Boebert from Colorado, okay? Lauren, I got sick last year. I had a touch of lymphoma, and I was going through chemo and all that. And Lauren was very, very good to me, very kind to me, kind of out of the blue. You never know who's going to show up when you get cancer. So we became friends, and before we were leaving for the last recess, I said to Lauren, what's wrong? She looked kind of upset. She said her boyfriend broke up with her. I said, like, the Beetlejuice guy? She said, yeah, the Beetlejuice guy. So I said, what happened? She said, he didn't like all the publicity. Plus, he's a Democrat. He owns a restaurant. They've got LGBTQ night. They've got a drag night. And all of his gay friends didn't like the fact that he was going out with me. And I said, that was very short-sighted and small-minded of them. They could have used it as an opportunity to educate you on all the rancid anti-gay legislation, you know. So she laughed, and somebody in her family is gay, and she said she told them. But I said, well, why are you still voting for all that stuff? And she said, well, you know, we're not that close. But and then I said she has given up the opportunity to create the greatest caucus in the history of the U.S. Congress, the LGBTQAnon caucus. But she said she's not QAnon anymore. So, but anyway, I have made friends who are Republicans, and I mean, they're, they're real friends. Like, I called Lauren last night before, because I was speaking at the 92nd Street Y, and I said, do you mind if I tell people there that you're my friend? Because people like to ask, do you have any friends on the other side? But nobody asked. So now I got the chance to drop her name. But, you can make real friends because, you know, the ideological or political spectrum doesn't define the spectrum of friendship any more than, you know, family relations necessarily defines it. There are people who feel closer to people who are not in their biological family than people who are outside and so on. So people, you know, structure it in different ways. And it's just close-minded to think that you're not going to be able to learn something for everybody. And my dad used to say, you know, I remember one of the kids in my family asking my dad, saying, can you say anything good about your enemy, like Richard Nixon? My dad was on Nixon's enemies list, so he was an official enemy of Richard Nixon. But my dad say, well, your enemy teaches you how to take strong action. And I've always kind of adhered to that. You know?
Shai, what are some of the things that you learn about, empathy and actually perhaps, you know, listening to your enemies and, you know, seeing everyone in a positive light? You write a bit about that, a lot about that in the book.
So Nachmanides, Ramban, in a really, really gorgeous way, talks about what it means to love your neighbor is to want them to have everything that you have to the same extent that you have it. It is an ethic of non-competition. An ethic of what I use the old Yiddish word to forgiven, lefargain in modern Hebrew, right? To really want others to blossom and thrive. And what I then suggest based on Ramban is that what he's really advocating is, to use a term from rabbinic ethics, ayin tova, a generous eye. Love, among other things, is also a way of seeing. And I'll give you a very concrete example. There's a text that I really came upon towards the very end of working on this book that just touched me very deeply. There is a Mishnah that says, a well-known Mishnah, Hevedan et kol ha'adam l'chaf zchut, right? Judge every person favorably. In his commentary on Pirkei Avot, the Haredi writer, Rabbi Natan Gestetner, not a name you often hear in, you know, more progressive Jewish circles. Natan Gestetner, following some other precedent, says, you know, we should probably read that phrase hyper-literally. Hevedan et kol ha'adam l'kaf zchut should mean, judge the entirety of the person favorably. And that means that when someone hurts you, you have the option of asking, what is the story of their life that led them here? And that's all about empathy. It's about, actually, can I look at someone who hurt me and say, you're not a monster, you're someone walking around with pain. And I understand, of course, that there are, you know, the journalist Ron Rosenbaum has this wonderful phrase, which he calls the argumentum ad Hitlerum. The argumentum ad Hitlerum means, no matter what you're talking about, you then say, oh yeah, and what about Hitler? And then whatever we were talking about, you know, the other side wins, because of course, like, Hitler breaks the categories. But one of the things that is very important to me to say in this book, okay, most people are not Hitler, right? The guy who does not like me and feels competitive with me is not Hitler. He's just a guy who doesn't like me and feels competitive with me. And I have the option of not just looking at the ways that she hurt me. I can actually look at the fullness of who that person is. And that also, you know, is connected to something that is emphasized by Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav and others, right? You know, when we're tempted to say about someone, they're a totally horrible person, it's worth asking whether that totally is justified. As Rabbi Nachman likes to say, is there really nothing that they've ever done that would modify that totally. That's also what empathy is about. It's really about a commitment to seeing in a particular way. And we live in a time that is so much not about that. It is really about the opposite. I mean, you think about how hard this is. I mean, you know, and I say this not in some combative way, quite the contrary. I was just talking to a Christian journalist yesterday about how, on the one hand, people talk about how the essence of Christian ethics is loving your enemies. And on the other hand, you have all these evangelicals walking around with t-shirts that say, "Let's go, Brandon." Right? This is very hard stuff. It's very hard to internalize this. And it's not like, you know, the political side that most of BJ is on is so pure in this way, right? There's also this kind of impulse. And Jamie's story about Lauren Boebert is really helpful in this way, right? Here's an example of someone many people in this room are probably tempted to vilify. And yet it's important to keep in mind, this is a person capable of moments of profound kindness. That's a different way of seeing.
When I read about your late son in your book, it struck me that he was a person of enormous empathy. And if you don't mind, I wonder if you could tell us a bit about your son. He seems like a remarkable person.
Yeah, very much so. Well, he had extraordinary love for the world, for animals, where I think real love starts in little children, real love for family, real love for friends. But, I mean, from the time of his being a little boy, we would be walking down the street and he'd stop and say, "Well, why don't we just go talk to that person and see if they want to come have lunch with us?" You know, and he had pretty much infinite empathy, and it was very hard for him. I mean, he would read about, you know, children starving in Yemen or the Saudi war in Yemen, and he would say, "Like, what are we going to do about this? Like, what are we going to do?" Like the way that a lot of people. My read didn't say I'll send some money to Amnesty International or I'll send some money to Oxfam, but for him, he felt these things the way you'd feel it about your brother or sister, you know? And so, you know, I was interested in the parts of your book about sort of degrees of empathy and compassion and love and your family and your friends and working your way out there, which might not be the highest form of love, at least, you know, when I look at my son's life, but it's certainly psychologically easier and more tenable than if you really open yourself up in an unlimited or, I guess to put it more negatively, an indiscriminate way to all the pain in the world. But he felt it, you know. And he was a second-year student at Harvard Law School when we lost Tommy. And he wanted to go to law school. I think he thought about using the law as an instrument of justice. But obviously, the law schools are not really principally set up with that in mind. It's a long road from law to justice, you know. And so, Tommy had a very short, remarkable life. He really did.
Thanks for sharing that. So, Shai, and not to compare, but I know you're a person who's also experienced a lot of loss in your life, and I wonder how that has influenced your thinking about love and about this book.
Yeah. First of all, Jamie, sorry. I lost my father when I was 12 years old, just kind of up and died one day. And within a year later, I was living alone with a mother who did not have any of the emotional or practical tools that would be required to raise a child. So really, from the time I was 12, I was kind of left with no choice but to try and raise myself. And I will say that I think part of what got me on this life course of thinking about love is that I was also the recipient of incredible generosity and hospitality from all kinds of people. People who either sensed or intuited that I didn't really have a home life in high school. And so would invite me and say, "Anytime it's Shabbat, you're welcome to be here." right? Things like that just had a really profound impact on me, and they really kind of set the course for me of when I started reading about how the sages of the Talmud talk about gmilut chasadim, acts of loving kindness, as the very height of human life. I sort of felt like I've experienced that. So in a funny way, my sort of journey to thinking about love came from a combination of being deprived and also being modeled for. And both of those experiences were very real and very formative. Writing the chapter on family was hard for me. And what I kept doing, which was actually very moving in the end, was thinking about the life I've built with Rachel as an alternative to the life I had at home. And there was something kind of really moving and inspiring about that. And it kind of kept grounding me, like, it's okay to write about this because, you know, this is like any trauma therapist line. The past is in the past. It's not happening now. But it's not an easy project when you've experienced that kind of loss and grief to, you know, to write about what a nurturing family environment really is. You know, I have for many years thought about the biblical mandate to love the stranger. Many people in this room have heard me talk about this on countless occasions. I would say that my own experience of living with chronic illness has forced me to really wrestle at a whole nother level with what compassion looks like and with why it can be so hard. You know, I'll share very personally that I think one of the processes that I've gone through in the last few years is, you know, I was so focused for so long on the idea of learning compassion from our own suffering. You were strangers in the land of Egypt, therefore love the stranger. Like, look at your pain and learn compassion from it. I was so focused there that I don't think I was fully honest with myself about the ways that illness can also make you angry and constricted and almost physically closed off into yourself. And it has forced me, my various experiences in the last few years have forced me, I think, to be compassionate to the parts of myself that have trouble being compassionate. And that, I hope, has made me even better at responding compassionately to other people who are having trouble with compassion, right? It's not that difficult to be compassionate to models of compassion. Like, if Thich Nhat Hanh approached me and said he was unhappy, I think I could love him. But like, when someone who drives me crazy approaches me and says they're having a hard time, it's like, oh, can I be present here in a way that is harder? So that's been really important. The combination, I would say, of loss and illness have been like a constant goad for me to learn compassion, but also crucially to relearn it and to be more honest with myself about how hard the learning of it can be.
And if you raised yourself, you did a good job.
Jamie, the idea of loving the stranger, is that something that has inspired your activism on behalf of immigrants and, what was your expression, vulnerable citizens of nowhere, a phrase that appears in a bill you just put forth?
Well, so that bill that I did with Senator Cardin is to create a pathway for citizenship for literally stateless people, you know, not people who've come undocumented but with another nation-state citizenship. But there's hundreds of there's millions of people on Earth who are stateless. There's hundreds of thousands, somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000 in America, of stateless people. And that, as Hannah Arendt talks about in The Origins of Totalitarianism, it's a really dangerous condition to be in, is to have no protection from any state, no rights or attributes under any state. But I found that the book really fascinating to deal with this in the realm of emotion and psychology and theology rather than law, which is, you know, law and politics, which is what we do in Congress. And I mean, I didn't know how much some people hated immigrants until I got to Congress. I really did not know how that can be the organizing principle of some people's political moral psychology. But so it's forced me to ask, like, a lot of serious questions. I mean, you know, if you believe in the nation state and I think most of us do, then inevitably there's got to be a membership policy or a border. And, you know, and I don't know how much people's feelings change about immigration not through a lawful channel based on how much they're exposed to lots of strangers coming in. I suppose the busing of the undocumented people to New York would make New York an interesting test case about it. You know, I don't know that loving the stranger means not having immigration laws or not enforcing immigration borders in the real world that we live in. I mean, you can make an argument the other way, that loving the stranger means creating lots more opportunities for people to get into our country lawfully and a lot fewer opportunities for people to get into the country unlawfully and dangerously, which is what it is. But it does force us to, you know, to ask the question about what it means to love the stranger in that overlapping category of the foreigner, right? Somebody who's, you know, who lives in a foreign land, right? And the stranger, I guess we are commanded, you remind me in your book, in Exodus and in Leviticus both, right, to the stranger amongst you shall be as the native born unto you. You are strangers in the land of Egypt, and I am the Lord your God, which sort of reminds people of the right relationship. God is above everybody, and everybody else is at the same level. But in the age of climate change and so much instability and resurgent authoritarianism, anti-Semitism, racism all over the world, the question of what we owe the stranger, I think, becomes more and more morally and politically urgent and requires us to try to figure out the political and legal answers to it that are ethically grounded and that make sense in the real world. So,
yeah, I mean, I think something that has been important for me to say is to be clear on what a text like the Torah can and can't do. So the preoccupation in the Torah with loving the stranger is not a policy prescription for contemporary America. Like, you can't read the Chumash and then say, okay, so how many Syrian immigrants should we take in this year? That's a kind of preposterous project. But what the Torah can do and does do is articulate an ethos of how one relates to immigrants. One can say that the demonization and dehumanization of immigrants is a theological abomination. One must say that if one wants to take Torah seriously. So I think it's useful to sort of be aware of what these texts, what work they do and what work they don't do, right? They are not an ancient Near Eastern text, no matter how holy and how sacred, is not a, you know, clear policy resource for, you know, the committee, you know, right? But it really does articulate an ethos. And I think that, ideally, religion that took the Bible seriously would be at the forefront of resisting the global turn to xenophobia.
Yeah. The confusion of theology and legislation, which I appreciate you're very careful not to indulge, has been on my mind a lot recently because, you know, we are now in a period where white Christian nationalism comes knocking on the door of Congress pretty much on a daily basis. And, I keep thinking about a day when Mike Johnson, now the Speaker of the House, but somebody I served with for 7 years in the Judiciary Committee and some of the other Republicans were talking because the Texas legislature had just endorsed the Ten Commandments. So they were saying, well, we should endorse the Ten Commandments, as if, you know, the Ten Commandments were waiting around for millennia just to be endorsed by the Freedom Caucus and the House of Representatives. And so I went to the House Rules Committee and I said to my friend, who was then the chairman, McGovern, I said, Jim, here's my proposal. If we're going to vote on the Ten Commandments, we should have to vote on each commandment separately, okay? And you can't vote for any commandment you ever violated, because then you'll be taking the name of the Lord in vain in violation of the third commandment. So they said that I was making mockery of the whole thing. I said, actually, you guys are making mockery out of the whole thing, because your resolution's both unconstitutional and it's blasphemous at the same time. You know, so it's pretty impressive.
Shai, let's talk a bit about God. And I'm just like going back to Tanakh, looking at the Bible. Often, you know, there's just so much violence and duplicity and bloodshed and all kinds of things. And then, you know, you're talking about a loving God. So, like, how does that all fit together?
How much time do you got? So first of all, actually, this is a useful place to talk about the internalization of traditional Christian anti-Judaism on the part of so many Jews, right? In other words, many Jews, most Jews in America, have internalized the narrative whereby the Old Testament God is a God of vengeance, the New Testament God is a God of love. My friend Brent Strawn, who's a Bible professor at Duke and a Christian, a devout Christian, says at one point, you know, for Christians who argue that the New Testament God is less violent than the God of the Hebrew Bible, I encourage you to go home and read the book of Revelation, which is far more violent than anything that happens in the Hebrew Bible. So the point of this, of course, is not, it's not about interreligious polemic. It's about saying that the problem of divine violence in Scripture is a problem that exists in, if I don't love this language, but both Testaments, right? In the Hebrew Bible as well as in the New Testament. Now, I think that everyone makes a choice about which texts to read in light of which. Everyone makes a choice about what is there, if you will, canon within the canon. So I want to just make two observations about the God of love in Tanakh. First of all, the verses in the Hebrew Bible that are quoted most often in the Hebrew Bible, right? So the verses that are quoted, right, interbiblically are Exodus 34, 6 and 7, Hashem, Hashem, El Rachum V'Chanun, Erech Apayim, etc. The Lord, merciful and just, etc. No verses in the Bible are quoted in the Bible more often. And interestingly, as the Bible goes on, the piece about ongoing punishment fades. There's actually really, it's really kind of an interesting development. That's piece number one. In other words, that I think you could argue that, you know, Jews are always hesitant about the idea that there's a theological center of Tanakh, but if there is one, you can make a strong case that it's those verses. It's a declaration of God's fundamentally merciful and loving nature. The text that has been so formative for me, I would say of almost all biblical texts, this is most critical to my own sort of theological thinking, is the 11th chapter of the book of Hosea, in which I think in one of the most remarkable moments in the Hebrew Bible, God says, you know, Jewish people, you'll pardon the anachronism, Israelites, I wish I could give you up because you're completely insufferable. And I wish that I could walk away, but I can't. And you know why I can't? Ki el anochi velo ish. Because I am God and not a person. Now, just think about this for a minute. If you're a student of medieval philosophy, you think, oh, I am God and not a person. Therefore, I don't really love. That's a human thing. Hosea says the exact opposite. Hosea says, I am God and not a human. That means that although your love as a human being is exhaustible and finite, my love as God is inexhaustible and infinite. My godness is a function of the inexhaustibility of my love. That's not the New Testament, right? That's Hosea. And it's such an interesting moment for actually just asking ourselves, what do we mean when we say that God is different than a person? Do we mean in the spirit of Maimonides, well, God doesn't really care because God is too transcendent for that? Or do we mean God is so loving that no human being can ever approach that? I mean, I often think about this wonderful phrase that Abraham Joshua Heschel, mentions in his book, The Prophets, or coins, really. He says, you know, to say that God loves is not anthropomorphism. To say that humans love is theomorphism. That is really, I think, very profound and very important. Now, I don't pretend for a second that I've then solved every problem of every biblical text that is violent or, you know, explosive. I don't pretend that at all. But I do think that there are, again, thrusts in the Bible that are really important and in light of which we should read other things. I just want to mention one sentence, if I could, about divine anger. So I think the problem of divine anger in Tanakh is often overkill. But divine anger itself is not necessarily a problem for two reasons. One is, to the extent that God is angry about the exploitation of widows and orphans, that's not the only thing God gets angry about, but it's a central one. So there is something extremely beautiful about the idea that someone somewhere actually cares about the downtrodden members of society, because most of the time we sure don't. I actually find that anger really moving. And then also, sometimes getting, and this is something I talk about in one of the chapters of the book, sometimes getting angry at someone is a way of showing them respect. If you behave horribly and I shrug, then either I don't care about what you're doing, or I don't respect you enough to have a moral reaction to you. This is something that the philosopher Peter Strawson argues. Anger can be a moral emotion. And I think part of the claim of the Hebrew Bible is that God takes us seriously as moral agents. And that means at times that God has moral anger. I don't think that's a bad thing. The explosiveness and the violence are more complicated. But the anger itself, I think, is worth wrestling with more deeply than we usually are willing to.
Can I just follow up with
please,
a question?
Please.
Right. So, but talk about your discussion of Abraham getting mad at God about his indiscriminate response to Sodom and Gomorrah.
The thing about that moment is, it's sometimes people say, oh, in that story, Abraham educates God. I think that's not a great reading of that story. Because it seems to me that that story is about God teaching Abraham to argue with power. And there is an astonishing passage in the Midrash that says that the original version, just get this for a second, the original version of Genesis did not say that when the angels left, Abraham was left standing with God, but rather said, when the angels left, God was left standing waiting for Abraham. As if to say, God was waiting for an opportunity to teach Abraham to argue with him. It's almost like God does not want a covenant partner who is afraid of the powerful. God does not want a leader who is afraid of his donors. And so I think that that's just very moving. By the way, that also happens with Moses. The rabbinic midrash on this, I think, is reading extremely sensitively. When God says to Moses, get off of me and let me kill them. That's a very strange way to begin a conversation, right? Imagine I walk into the room and I say, you know, don't try to stop me. What I'm really doing is trying to teach you to try and stop me. And I think both of those, Abraham and Moses, right, the two giant figures, are actively kind of taught by God, argue, damn it, argue. Even when God does something, you are a moral agent. You can speak. All the more so that should be true in the face of human power.
And it was about violence and war, right?
Well, the challenge is about God wanting to wipe out the Sodomites for their extraordinary cruelty, their interpersonal brutality. The sin of, if you will, sodomy in the Bible is inhospitality.
Mm-hmm. And Abraham says, you intend to slaughter the innocent as well as the guilty.
Right. I think the passage is actually extremely difficult because it's conventional to say that Abraham is arguing for justice for the righteous. He is, but he's also appealing to the justice of the righteous to appeal for mercy for the unrighteous. something I think in that story is not always clear or dilated, right? In other words, would you, I don't think he's just saying save 10. He's saying, right, save the city on because there are these 10, right? So it's an appeal for justice and mercy interwoven, which I think is quite important.
Jamie, I noticed your book is full of notes. I wonder if there's anything else you want to ask Shai?
Can I look, consult my notes?
I yes, you should run for president.
You have a great handwriting there. It's hard not to notice.
Well, actually, back on the theme of loving the enemy, it seems like part of what you want to say there is definitional. Is your enemy really your enemy? Or what does it mean to be an enemy? Or is there really anyone who's your total enemy? And I just want to make sure I'm catching you right on that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I guess what I would say that I think rabbinic ethics is saying, and here this is obviously me talking based on a whole array of sources,
yeah,
and there are probably different ways of reading this, is that you do have real enemies, most likely. Be careful about your assumption that everyone you don't like or everyone who doesn't like you falls into that category. I mean, I talk about this one midrash, and this is actually kind of an explosive way to end in a way, but I talk about this one midrash in the midrash on Proverbs, Midrash Mishlei, that is a really shocking text. So many of you are familiar with the rabbinic principle that if someone is coming to kill you, you have to kill them first. Hashkem v'horogo. The Midrash in Midrash Mishlei says, if your enemy comes to kill you and enters your home and is hungry, give him a meal. And God will reconcile. Yashlimenu lach. God will reconcile the two of you. So this is kind of insane, right? And it's important that it's a midrash rather than a halakha, rather than a law. Meaning it's not telling you every time someone comes into your house, you know, feed them. But I think what it's saying is every time you're tempted to write someone off as a implacable enemy, just make sure you're right. You know, when I first came upon that midrash, I found myself thinking about those, you know, rare but moving stories of people who invite white supremacists over for Shabbos and you know, sometimes change their hearts. So I don't think the idea is that we don't actually have enemies. I think the idea is to constrict the category of who we define that way and to believe in the possibility of changes of heart, which is so hard to believe in our day and age, but to believe in the possibility that people can actually change. And after all, that's at the center of Jewish spirituality more broadly. The very notion of tshuva is the idea that we can change our own hearts. It reminds me, and maybe the last thing I'll say, is that Søren Kierkegaard, the great Christian philosopher, has this wonderful line where he says that part of what it means to love someone is to insistently believe in their own capacity for love. Right? It's so hard to do that with people you don't like. It's such a powerful spiritual practice, right? To just, no, this person, Lauren Boebert, is capable of loving Jamie Raskin. That's important. It's not a small thing.
So we're just about out of time, but I just thought we'd end on a kind of practical and upbeat note. So Shai writes, we wait and we hope for God. We wait and hope for a world in which human dignity is real and the presence of God is manifest. But waiting and hoping are active, not passive. I wonder if you could each just give us some practical, theological, political advice, comments on what we can all do to enhance human dignity these days.
In 60 seconds or less, Jamie.
This is the 18th state I've been to, because I'm crisscrossing America, for democracy. And people don't tend to close these meetings by asking about love, but they ask about hope, which I think is connected to it. And when I was a kid, my dad used to say to us, when everything looks hopeless, you're the hope. And I feel I one time saw a speech by Nelson Mandela where he said people asked him how he maintained his hope when he was in Robben's Island, and he said, well, optimism is a personality characteristic. You tend to be born with it or not, and you're more or less optimistic or pessimistic, he said. But hope anybody can have, whether you're an optimist or a pessimist. Hope's a choice. Hope is a choice you make that's connected to how you act. And I think it's a virtue of this fine book that, in my mind, it's implanted the connection between hope and love. That love is what's really underlying hope, that you have that kind of passionate or amorous or emotional connection to a country or institutions or a constitution, a community. It's what real patriotism is about. And that kind of love, if you hang on to it, you hang on to your love and keep it strong, then you will be able to generate the hope that you need to get through the toughest of times. So thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah, I think I would say something similar in a, perhaps not surprisingly, theological frame, which is that, to me, one of the things it means to strive to worship a transcendent God is that a transcendent God means that every earthly status quo is relativized and not ultimate. Only God is ultimate. No political arrangement is ultimate. No status quo is ultimate. There is always the possibility of nurturing ourselves with the understanding that God wants the world to be other than it presently is. There, and that that is like the ultimate, that the source of life is on the side of life. I think, Sandy, that the thing I would say about, very specifically about your question, it's very important to me that we be honest about the ways that being focused on human dignity can be a profoundly countercultural act. Because our society in all kinds of ways tries to turn us off to the dignity of at least some people. I mean, we live in a society in which we talk about being heirs of the Bible, which talks about every human being being in the image of God, and we live in a neighborhood in which people sleep in their own urine. And somehow it's okay. But it's not okay. And for me, at least, it's important to really see the continuum. And sometimes I say this, and I'm afraid people think I'm completely out of my mind, but this is really important to me. There is a continuum, a profound continuum, between holding the door for the person behind you and caring profoundly about human rights. That is to say, dignity is either something that pervades your life, or it's something that we don't really believe in. And we don't have a choice, I think, at least not normatively, to choose. I'm going to pick my spots about dignity. I don't think that's how it works. The demand is much more intense than that. Or if you prefer, the aspiration of love is much more powerful than that.
Well, thank you. Thank you both.